Hello and welcome to NewsHour from the BBC World Service, coming live from London. This is Owen Bennett-Jones. Now, the German elections are on tomorrow, and with the growing rift between the United States and Europe, they are taking on ever more importance. That's the international side of it. Domestically, the German economy remains in recession, and migration has been a huge issue in the campaign. And to bring it all together for us, NewsHour's James Kumarasamy joins us live now from Berlin. James.
Yes, thanks, Owen. It does feel like a big moment, almost exactly 3 years after the outgoing Social Democrat Chancellor Olaf Scholz declared a turning point in Germany's foreign and defence policy after the full-scale Russian invasion of Ukraine. Germany could be on the verge of a political turning point. Opinion polls suggest that the AfD, a still relatively new far-right party, still considered beyond the pale by Germany's political centre, could be on course to win around a fifth of the vote, more than ever before, and to strain as never before the so-called firewall that's kept it out of power nationally. All that moribund economy you mentioned, those strains over migration policy underlined by recent attacks by migrants and asylum seekers, including one just yesterday evening here in this city, have boosted a party which promises to control borders, even to carry out mass deportations, and which casts itself as an alternative for Germans who feel ignored by the political mainstream. That said, it is a mainstream party, the Christian Democrats or CDU, that leads in the polls. Its candidate, Friedrich Merz, tipped to lead the next government. But here in the eastern part of Germany, the electoral map is certain to feature large swathes of AfD blue. And to get a flavour of opinion, a sense of the historical moment, I travelled about an hour out of Berlin to the town of Strausberg in Brandenburg State. My guide there, the British-German historian Katja Hoyer, who grew up in the town in the twilight years of communist East Germany.
Jamie, Kumarasamy, nice to meet you. How are you?
Yeah, nice to meet you.
This is your hometown,
yeah,
then?
Well, it was for a while. We moved a lot when I was a kid. But yeah, that was kind of the time that I remember the most, yeah.
Fantastic. Yeah. We're going to do a little tour then, aren't we?
Yeah, welcome to the provinces.
So, Katja, so tell us, just to describe this place and where we are and what the sort of politics here are, really.
Yeah, so we are in Strausberg, just outside of Berlin. It's a real mix of people here, people who've always lived here, but also people who've recently moved out when Berlin has sort of outpriced them. So it's an interesting political landscape here, with a real mix of political opinions and also age groups. It's perhaps a bit different from a lot of other East German towns in that it hasn't actually lost its population in the same way. Rather changed it over time, but not really kind of, you know, become one of these completely deserted places.
And has its politics been changing?
It has. It used to be quite a left-wing landscape here, and now recently the AfD has also managed to make huge inroads. But in contrast to lots of other places in the East, it is still very mixed. So it's got the AfD quite strong, but also Die Linke, the left-wing party, and the SPD as well. So it's, I think, a sign that its population is a bit more varied than in lots of other places.
And what has led to the AfD advancing here?
I think the AfD has advanced here, particularly amongst the sort of original inhabitants, if you will, rather than the people who've moved out of Berlin to come here. You know, they say that the town's changed, that it's not the same place anymore, that more basically asylum seekers, but also workers have moved in from other countries, and that's why the sort of way the town looks and feels has changed, and the people who are uneasy about that are often the ones who've recently turned to the AfD.
Well, it's a lovely town, I have to say, in this main street. Excuse me, would you like to talk to us about the elections?
No.
That's a no. That's another no. Okay. She wished us luck, but that's another no. Right, interesting. Well, we've bumped into a group of people standing outside having cigarettes, and they are a captive audience for us. So we're going to ask them about the election tomorrow. So tell us, how are you feeling ahead of this election? On social media, do you see lots of things from the AfD?
So I personally don't, because that's not my algorithm. But I know from my little sister, for example, that her classmates, they have a lot of right-winged and also a lot of AfD content in their bubble on social media. And that's something that is driving them to their political views. Also, the families are not really concerned about those kids. And everyone knows it's a problem, but it's somewhat difficult to handle that. What's really interesting, they're not old enough to vote, but they already have a huge interest in all these topics. And even my sister calls them AfD-Wähler, so AfD voters, even though she's not old enough to vote, they're not old enough to vote.
So, Katya, we've come to this big sports complex where you used to come and do your gymnastics. Sadly, the gymnastics hall is closed, but out here we've got the football pitches. I mean, what memories do you have here? What does this evoke for you?
Very positive childhood memories, really, for me. It's not far from where my kindergarten and my school were, and it was kind of in walking distance, or I'd cycle out from home. It was really a sort of quite idyllic way, I guess, of growing up at the time.
Right, there's a young footballer running over to talk to us now.
Yeah, so, well, look, tell us, we're here because the election is tomorrow in Germany. How are you feeling about the election?
I'm really nervous right now, because I think in this time now, a lot of things happen in Germany, and maybe the people are thinking it's all about the immigrants.
So when you say incidents happening with immigrants, I mean, you're talking about things like what happened in Berlin yesterday, the stabbing?
Yes, yes.
You think people you talk to, do you get a sense then that more people are going to vote AfD as a result?
Yes, maybe.
We've come to the station here in Strasbourg. We've accosted two guys who are just buying some lunch. What are your thoughts ahead of the election tomorrow? How important is the election?
Oh, I think for myself, like for the development in Deutschland.
So there needs to be a really big change in Germany, but this man doesn't think that a big change is going to come about, because it looks like we're just going to get a chancellor who's a new face, but they will have to work with the same parties again.
What sort of change would you like to see?
The AfD must be respected and its voters must be respected. They are important. They're about a fifth of the population now. They should be taken seriously. The AfD will be bigger. It will on its own bring about some change. It can't just be Merz. He needs to take those voters into account for a real change in this country.
So, Katja, we're going to head back into Berlin now. But look, thanks for the tour and speaking to folks. I just wonder your reflections on the people we've spoken to, or the people who didn't want to speak to us today.
Yes, I got the sense that there is a lot of tension in the air. Certainly everyone seems worried that the election will not bring what they want, and that I think maybe the biggest fear that most people have in common, regardless of their politics, is the sense that not a stable government might come out of this, and something, you know, sort of middle of the road, very fractured, will happen, and you end up with a continuation, really, of the very divided politics that we have seen so far, and that seems to be something that worries everybody, those who want change, but also those who fear the types of changes that we see in society.
The British-German historian Katja Hoyer, returning to her hometown and being the guide for us there, the town of Strasbourg in Brandenburg. Well, the emotions that have been stirred up by this election campaign have been expressed in quite a few political street protests over the last few weeks, and including one that took place in the centre of Berlin today, and my colleague Max Horbury went along.
It's the day before the German general election in central Berlin. I'm standing in front of a huddle of protesters. Some of them are holding signs that read Omas gegen rechts, grannies against the right. I'm here with one of their members, Marianne Zepp.
It's the first time in post-Fight Germany that we have a right-wing extremist party, which is even a fascist party, which is supposed not only to be represented in Bundestag, but also they are gaining in votes. And we are worried about to bring the democratic parties, not to build any coalition or start any cooperation with the right-wing party. I mean, we are in Germany. This idea of never again is still very vivid, and especially in our generation. I mean, we are the first post-war generation after Nazism, and so we are very much aware to raise our voices against fascism.
So when you think about when you were a young woman, how different was, you know, the attitude towards the far right?
We had the feeling that, okay, there were a few old Nazis, there were a few young Nazis, but they never ever gained any public voice. We were living in a democracy. I think that for my generation, nobody would ever guess that we were dealing with the right-wing movement as this size at our old age.
In front of us, the police had used vans to block our access to Friedrichstrasse, one of Berlin's main thoroughfares. The crowd grew and grew, and then the reason for the protest. It was difficult to see through the police vans, but marching down Friedrichstrasse were neo-Nazis. They had no signs or political affiliations on them. They were dressed in black and waved huge German flags. Some of the protesters, obstructed by the police, went around the block. I followed them, and by the time I caught up, it was clear that the two sides had clashed. There was a cloud in the air, and it smelled of smoke, and several protesters were doubled over, clutching their eyes. It seemed the police had broken it up and used pepper spray against the anti-far-right protesters. From then on, the two sides were stood chanting at each other, separated by a line of police in full body armour. On the eve of the German election, in the streets of central Berlin, on one side, anti-far-right protesters, and on the other, around 200 neo-Nazis.
And that was Max Horbury reporting a flavour there of the tensions being expressed on the streets just before this key election in Germany.
James, just stay with us one second. You're doing all the coverage tomorrow. It does sound very tense. I mean, are you surprised, actually, first of all, on what you've just seen? And then just tell us what you're going to do tomorrow.
Well, it's been coming for some time, hasn't it? I mean, clearly this campaign has stirred up a lot of tensions, and you know, these attacks that have taken place have made things even more tense, I suppose. I'm looking for a better word, but I can't really find one at the moment. There's a great deal of uncertainty. The Trump factor, it's all stirred the pot, and people here are very worried. I mean, yes, as you say, we will be covering the results. They come in from around 6 p.m. local time. We'll have full coverage on NewsHour tomorrow. A great deal of uncertainty, a great deal of expectation as well here in Germany ahead of these federal elections.
Thanks very much. James Kumarasamy there. And coming up on this programme, we'll hear from the director of The Apprentice, a controversial film about a young Donald Trump, which has gathered two Best Actor nominations at the Oscars.
The closer we got to the elections, the more jittery they became. And at some point, some of the financiers, they wanted to pressure us into cutting scenes that they felt could make him angry. We had to buy out our reluctant American investors.
That's just coming up in around 20 minutes' time. Some headlines. There's been a delay to the release of hundreds of Palestinians from Israeli jails, hours after Hamas freed six hostages from Gaza. And the Vatican says the Pope's health has deteriorated after spending more than a week in hospital with pneumonia. You're listening to NewsHour. Now, the US President Donald Trump has fired the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, C.Q. Brown, the highest-ranking officer in the country. Other senior officers also being replaced. General Brown was the second black officer to hold the post. The US Defense Secretary, Pete Hegseth, had said that he should be fired because of his woke focus on diversity, equity, and inclusion programs in the military. Another one sacked Admiral Lisa Franchetti, the first woman to serve as Chief of Naval Operations. Well, let's hear now from Jason Crow, Democratic Congressman from Colorado, joining us live, sits on the Armed Services Committee. These are unusual things to happen, aren't they? What do you make of it?
Hi there. Well, they're more than unusual. They're deeply troubling. There's no precedent for what we are facing here right now. You know, every president has the right to put commanders in place that would fulfill their policies. But this is different. This is a large-scale purge. It's based on loyalties, and the people that are replacing these commanders are largely not ready for the job, not as experienced, and people who pass a litmus test of Trump loyalty. So disturbing, to say the least.
Now, there are people who've been fired who are referred to as JAG. There was a TV series called JAG. Can you tell us what that means and why it's important?
Yeah, so, you know, I'm a former military officer. I was a paratrooper, an Army Ranger. I served overseas in combat in Iraq and Afghanistan. And these JAG officers, they're Judge Advocate General, is what JAG stands for. These are the military lawyers. These are actually military officers, you know, captains, majors, colonels. And their job is to interpret the law of war, to interpret any applicable law and the Constitution, if need be, to determine if an order is lawful and in compliance with the law or constitutional. So the implication here is that if they are purging all of the JAG officers and replacing them with Trump loyalists, then these individuals whose job it is to tell commanders what's lawful and constitutional or not will be more loyal to Donald Trump than to the law and to the Constitution. And the obligation of military officers and senior commanders to refuse an unlawful order would be harder to enforce because they're not being backed by the opinions of these JAG officers.
There is some international opinion that the United States is becoming more authoritarian, and you're talking about loyalty to the president and so on. Do you share that language?
What I know is happening is we are sliding towards an oligarchy, number one. We see billionaires like Elon Musk and others who are consolidating power, who are making policy outside of the checks and balances that are occurring. You know, I have long said that Donald Trump has authoritarian tendencies. He frequently talks about being a dictator, about his love and appreciation for dictators and autocrats around the world. So we are in a very precarious position right now. I'm keeping not just a close eye, but I'm fighting back and pushing back hard on what is happening to stop us sliding towards an anti-democratic place right now.
When you speak to Republicans in Congress, do they share your perceptions when speaking to you privately?
Many of them do. Yeah, many of them do, and long time.
What are they doing? Because they're not saying anything.
Well, you know, what we lack is political courage, right? I mean, and political courage is not pushing back against the opposite party or the other side of the aisle. Political courage is when you push back against your own people. So a lot of them know what's going on and are disturbed by what's going on, but they're trying to keep their jobs. They are trying to keep their heads down because Donald Trump has captured the Republican Party. It doesn't really exist anymore. It's the party of Donald Trump. And if people stick their head out and oppose him, they are primaried and they lose their seat. So what we need is people who are willing to step up and sacrifice for the good of the country.
I've seen some town hall meetings in various parts of the United States over the weekend where some Republican congressmen were receiving criticism from their voters. Is that significant or not much?
Well, it's too early to tell. I mean, I do like seeing that because what we do need to have is, you know, Republican voters, moderates, people who may have voted for Donald Trump to make a difference on the price of goods, to bring down the cost of living, to make their life better as they thought that he would, who have now come to realize, many of them are starting to realize that he's not doing any of that. You know, he's not doing anything to address the cost of living. He's not doing anything other than placating, you know, his billionaire donors. And people are starting to see that more and more. So, yes, it does matter. It needs to be sustained. It needs to be built. And the pressure in these red Republican districts needs to be undeniable, and it needs to be tremendous for these folks to start stepping up to do the right thing.
Thanks for talking to us. That was Democratic Congressman Jason Crowther. Right, well, let's get the take of Boris Bondarov. Now, he is a former Russian Foreign Ministry official who worked at the Russian mission to the UN in Geneva, but then in May 22 resigned in protest over the Russian invasion of Ukraine. So he is someone who took a stand, and we consulted him on what's going on the Ukraine issue and more generally how he analyses what's happened in U.S.-Russian relations since President Trump has come to power.
Trump is eager to change U.S. foreign policy very drastically, to be very much unlike his predecessor. And also, I think he wants to achieve some of very important foreign political goals for the United States by making Vladimir Putin his friend or even an ally against China. I think that is the most obvious and logical explanation.
Yes, that's interesting you say that, because there's lots of speculation in the United States as to why President Trump seems so pro-President Putin, you know, in his first term and his second term now. But you think it's all to do with China?
Maybe not all, but Trump has always stated that to contain China, to compete with China strategically, economically, is his main goal. And he considers China to be a United States rival. Evidently, Putin's Russia is not a rival in Trump's eyes. It's a small economy, it's a huge nuclear arsenal, and it's better to have Vladimir Putin out of this, you know, bilateral U.S.-China competition.
You're living in Switzerland. You obviously get the European perspective as well. Europe, the European Union, has never had a unified foreign policy, really. Do you think it will now need to get one, or does it not need one and can continue just thinking about trade and not assert itself internationally?
The European Union doesn't need strategy right now. It needs it 3 years ago, at least, when the war had started. For these 3 years, Europeans have not produced anything which could be characterized as a strategy or a plan of action. And if you, as someone said, when you don't know where to sail, no wind is favorable.
Well, I mean, is that quite fair? I mean, the European Union may not have had such a strategy, but nor did the United States, did it? I mean, you know, they were pretty much in lockstep in allowing Ukraine to defend itself, but not to inflict a defeat on Russia.
Absolutely, absolutely. The United States didn't, and they haven't yet produced any sustainable strategy either. But the United States, I think they can afford it more than Europe can.
So one of the questions that's beginning to be asked is, are the changes that Trump are making irreversible? Or if in 2 years, you know, American politics does its thing and the Democrats make a big comeback in Congress and he looks much weaker, will this moment pass?
Trump hasn't yet done much in real action. Yeah, in terms, he has spoken a lot, but his actions are not that, you know, impressive so far. But I think his rhetoric has already damaged the trust between America and Europe. America will never be again a trusted partner as it used to be. But it looks quite dangerous right now.
And that's former Russian diplomat Boris Bondarov, now living in Switzerland. And welcome back to NewsHour. Now, the Vatican has said that Pope Francis is in a critical condition after he suffered a long asthmatic respiratory crisis that required high flows of oxygen. He knows he is in danger, said one of his staff, and he told us to relay that. Well, the BBC's Sarah Rainsford is in Rome. What more can you tell us, Sarah?
Well, I can say that this is certainly the starkest statement that we've had yet from the Vatican. It is interesting that Pope Francis has said to his doctors and to officials at the Vatican that he wants openness about his condition. And this kind of statement, in fact, people here are telling me who have been watching the Vatican very closely for years that this kind of statement is actually unprecedented. And it does make clear that the Pope continues to be in a critical condition, but going into real detail about this crisis of breathing, essentially, that he had earlier today, and also blood transfusions. That's the first time we've heard about that. So he is obviously in a serious state, and they are, they say, withholding any prognosis for now. They also say he is suffering more today than he was yesterday. But despite that, the Vatican statement underlines that he did sit up in his armchair today, so he's not entirely bedridden. But I think it is a little bit, not surprising perhaps, but worrying for Catholics following this around the world, because yesterday we heard from the Pope's doctors for the first time. They came out and they made public statements, and they were very detailed. And although, again, their prognosis was pretty stark, they also seemed to be quite upbeat. They said the Pope had been joking and laughing, and he had maintained his sense of humour, and they also underlined that he was still sitting in his armchair. So I think one line stuck out to me. They said he is the Pope, they said, but he is still a man. And of course, he's an elderly man, 88, and not in the best of health even before this.
Well, that's right, because he had lung issues as a younger man, didn't he?
Yeah, he actually is missing part of one lung since, as a young man, yeah, he suffered illness and that was removed. So he has struggled with bronchitis in the past. He has had pneumonia in the past and he now has double pneumonia. So, yeah, he's not in the best of health. Of course, he is in a wheelchair too. He has problems with sciatica. He has problems with his knee. He has written about it in his biography that came out not very long ago. And he talked about his ill health and struggles in hospital that he had with some fairly serious surgery last 2023 and 2021. So, you know, he is elderly, he is frail. But I think it was interesting that the doctors talking about that yesterday said, you know, he wouldn't have got through all of that if he weren't a fighter. And they said he is still fighting right now. He certainly hasn't given up.
And just quickly, so people who are concerned about this, basically the Vatican are sending out statements quite frequently, at least daily.
They send out one in the morning that tells you how right. He slept and whether he had breakfast, and they send out this more detailed statement in the evening. And yesterday, as I say, we heard from the doctors. So there's not a big crowd of worried Catholics gathering in St. Peter's Square right now, but certainly there have been people bringing flowers and candles to the hospital in Rome where the Pope's being treated, yep. And people here saying that they are watching very closely.
Thank you very much for bringing us up to date with that news from Rome. That was the BBC's Sarah Rainsford there. Now we're going to the Middle East, where six hostages were today freed by Hamas and 600 Palestinian prisoners are due to be released. The BBC's Sebastian Usher joined me about an hour ago and told me there has been a delay to the Palestinian releases.
Yes, there's clearly a delay. It hasn't been announced officially by Israel, but none of them have yet been released. They were named. We have an idea of who is due to be released. Mm. Hasn't happened. We know that the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is meeting top security officials and that this is being discussed and that a decision will be made during that and will presumably be made public. And then we might see the Palestinian prisoners as scheduled in this exchange, but they're released still late tonight, or it might be a further delay.
You said that we have a pretty good idea of who the Palestinian prisoners are. Can you just tell us a bit about that?
Around 400 of them are people who've been detained since October the 7th. I mean, Israel arrested thousands of Palestinians in the wake of that. Many of them have been detained without charge. They will be returned, most of them, to Gaza. They're also, as we've seen before, but again, a larger number of Palestinians who've been serving long sentences. And there's one, Nael Barghouti, who's been in prison for around 45 years. He was originally jailed for killing an Israeli taxi driver back in 1978.
Is the Israeli media saying anything as to why there may be a delay?
There's sort of speculation, yes. There was huge anger and shock in Israel after one of the hostages who was returned in a coffin on Thursday, Shiri Bibas, it was found that although Hamas said that it was her who was being returned with her two young children, forensic investigation found that it wasn't her. That caused the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to say that Hamas would pay a heavy price for this, but it was an evil violation of a ceasefire agreement. And within a day or so, Hamas gave to the Red Cross another body or another set of human remains, and that then was found by forensic investigations in Israel to be Shiri Bibas.
This was meant to be a three-stage ceasefire deal and process. There seems so much distrust between the two sides. Can you see this moving forward to stage two and three?
I mean, I think the way that it was arranged was to try to build trust each step along the way, that perhaps Israel and Hamas would begin to have a little more trust, but that hasn't been what's happened. I mean, we've had time and time again moments when it looked like the ceasefire would go completely off track for various reasons. We haven't really got beyond that. And by concentrating and focusing on each week, whether the hostage handover, the release of the prisoners will happen as scheduled, it's caused those negotiations that were meant to have started earlier this month on the second phase, not to start. Nothing's happened. No talks have been held. And they are the really more difficult, intractable issues that have to be addressed about what Hamas's role will be in Gaza, and also whether the Israeli government is willing to accept not just a full troop withdrawal, but a relaxing of the security stranglehold that it's had on Gaza.
And that was the BBC's Sebastian Usher there. Well, among the six hostages freed by Hamas in return for the Palestinian prisoners that are due to be released were an Israeli Bedouin and an Ethiopian-born man who'd been in Gaza for years before the October the 7th, 2023 attack. Both of them had. They both actually wandered into Gaza around a decade ago, two separate incidents. Well, earlier I spoke to Mekdes Tamana, who's part of the Ethiopian-Israeli community, an activist who's campaigned for the release of this Ethiopian, and she was actually waiting outside the hospital where he was to catch a glimpse of him today and was able to speak to his brother.
We see his brother. His name is Ilan, and his sister, and they say he's okay. He tell me that we're happy that he's coming back home, that he's alive, but they know he needs his time to healing. Mentally, physically, he recognized when he hugged them. He said the name of the family. He have 10 brothers and sisters and nephews. I don't know how much.
Do you think more could have been done by the Israeli government to get him released?
They don't do nothing. They come to the family. This one I heard from the family. When it passed 4 months, and they tell them, be quiet, because it's not safe to say this in the media. We bring Avera home like this.
What's going to happen to Avera Mengistu now? Presumably, this will be a very long period of recovery.
Yeah, it's going to be long recovering, first of all. Second of all, family and Avera, they need their time. And for us, important for us, you hear the story about Avera Mengistu, Ethiopian Israel Jewish from Ashkelon. You hear in his story, tell it to everybody, who is this hero, survived this terrorist Hamas, murdering people 10 years, that is a hero.
That was Ethiopian Israeli activist Mekdes Tamana there. A cryptocurrency firm called Bybit said hackers stole, wait for this, $1.5 billion worth of digital currency, the biggest crypto theft in history, which I guess makes it the biggest theft in history, full stop. Even more amazing, the company says it can afford to refund everyone who's had their cryptocurrency stolen. Connor Sefton is a journalist and host of Crypto Today. It's a podcast. First of all, how is it possible to steal quite as much money as this?
We're still finding out, but crypto exchanges like Bybit use cold storage. This refers to cryptocurrency wallets that are disconnected from the internet, and that's actually meant to reduce the risks of these hacks happening. But what seems to have happened is that in a very sophisticated attack, these hackers managed to gain control of this wallet and get funds sent to wallets that were in their control.
Well, yes, I was wondering about that too. So have they literally cashed all this cryptocurrency in into hard currency?
No, not yet. So one benefit that we have with cryptocurrency is that actually a lot of the transactions can be traced. So at the moment, this $1.4 billion worth of cryptocurrency is spread across dozens of crypto wallets. And at the moment, some of it's lying dormant and is yet to be moved. And some of it is in the process of being transferred, but it hasn't been converted into dollars or local currencies yet.
But if you're saying it can be traced, does that mean it can be recovered?
Typically, the success rate of getting funds recovered is pretty mixed. Initial investigations suggest that this hack was linked to a group called the Lazarus Group, which is a North Korean-sponsored hacking group. And generally speaking, they've been very successful of holding on to funds and, according to the US, using it to fund things like their ballistic missile program.
Yeah. And one of the things I mentioned in the introduction, you know, it's extraordinary that a company could pay refunds to everyone who's lost their money, you know, a billion pounds, billion dollars or more. Mm-hmm. I mean, how much money are these people making? I mean, it sounds like they're stealing the money off of it. I mean, that's ridiculous, isn't it? How can a company have $1 billion in its back pocket to refund everyone?
Well, what typically happens with exchanges is they will make fees and commissions whenever cryptocurrency is traded on their platform. Bybit is one of the world's biggest exchanges, and there's been a surge in activity because of the recent uptick in cryptocurrency prices. But generally speaking, following the collapse of FTX, the exchange run by Sam Bankman-Fried, exchanges have been trying to be more financially resilient and more transparent with their customers.
And apparently, we'll see. Maybe they won't be able to pay them back, but they say they can.
Mm-hmm. Yes, well, I mean, by the looks of things, they have well over $10 billion currently in their reserves. Uh-huh. And we've seen over the past 24 hours that customers who have wanted to withdraw money from Bybit have been able to do so. And normally when you see if a crypto exchange is in distress, generally speaking, those withdrawals can't be made.
And that was Connor Sefton there. Now, a few months ago, the film The Apprentice was struggling to get distribution in the US because of its controversial subject matter, the young Donald Trump. But two actors from it have now got Oscar nominations, and Vincent Dowd has been speaking to the film's director, Ali Abassi.
Hello, this is Donald Trump from Mr. Cohn. Thank you so much.
Donald who?
Yeah, you're brutal.
Work on a feature film on Donald Trump began in his first White House term. In the Biden years, the idea progressed, but then, says director Ali Abassi, some financial backers developed cold feet.
The closer we got to the elections, the more jittery they became. And at some point, some of the financiers, they wanted to pressure us into cutting scenes that they felt could make him angry. We had to buy out our reluctant American investors.
When eventually the film was released, Donald Trump branded it a cheap, defamatory and politically disgusting hatchet job. But there's been praise for actor Sebastian Stan, Academy Award nominated for playing Mr. Trump in his 20s.
From the sea to the sky, some say the age of Trump has begun.
Trump Tower, Trump City, Trump Plaza, Trump Castle. Does he go coming?
At first, Stan makes him sympathetic as Donald Trump finds a much-needed mentor in wealthy New York lawyer and businessman Roy Cohn. Portrayed as slightly naive, Trump is taken aback to realise that Cohn is gay and at his ruthless business methods.
This is the most important rule of all, okay? No matter how beaten you are, you claim victory and never admit defeat. Never admit defeat, Donald.
Playing Cohn is Jeremy Strong, star of the hit series Succession. He's nominated as Best Supporting Actor as the hugely forceful lawyer feared and admired in the New York business world. Would you say that the relationship between Trump and Cohn is the core of the movie? In a funny sort of way, it's almost like a love story.
Yeah, it is a love story. When I read the historical accounts of how they met and knowing that young Donald would fit perfectly, actually, as Roy Cohn's type, tall, blonde, sort of a little bit innocent and provincial, it could have started as almost like Roy had a crush on it. But then as it develops, I think there was genuine love and affection. And by that, I don't mean in necessarily a sexual way. And Donald saw in Roy a mentor figure or father figure.
The dysfunctional relationship with his father, Fred, suggested by the film, may be a reason why Donald Trump has so disliked it, along with a scene of violence against his first wife, Ivana. The story ends before Trump finds fame on American TV, but by then, says Ali Abassi, the cinema audience can see what lies ahead.
He's bullied his way into his business, getting into politics, becoming president, to silence the media, to get the oligarchy on his side.
Mr. Trump's lawyers described The Apprentice as a concoction of lies that repeatedly defames President Trump and constitutes direct foreign interference in America's elections. But the fact it has two performances, nominated at the Oscars on March the 2nd, has given it a media profile in America which had appeared unlikely.
Don't you forget, I made you.
There we are. That was Vincent Dowd speaking to Ali Abassi, who directed The Apprentice. A Amidst all the talk of Ukraine and Gaza and so on in recent weeks, there has been another cultural front line in the US under President Trump, which hasn't got so much attention. That's the world of scientific research. To give just one example, the US Epidemiological Society will not be meeting this year. An email cancelling that event went out a couple of days ago. Professor Walter Willett is a professor of epidemiology and nutrition at Harvard. What changes has the Trump administration made?
There have been many changes, and I could go on for quite a while. They come under several major categories. One is obstructing communication and censorship, withholding funding, and blocking collaboration.
That's a lot. So when you say stopping communication, that's conferences being cancelled.
It's more than that. It's scientists who work at NIH and other national research laboratories have essentially been gagged. They can't travel to joint scientific meetings and they can't attend virtually. And also, that means that some big meetings have been canceled, like the American Epidemiologic Society meeting that is coming up in a few weeks was canceled because those working at the Centers for Disease Control and NIH, a large part of the membership couldn't attend.
Right. But some of this is clearly, I mean, one can understand the politics of it. You're not allowed to publish stuff on gender issues, on climate change. You know, these are hot political issues. Epidemiology, is that due to vaccine skepticism? What's behind it?
It's hard to know what's behind that, but I would say that things like climate change and equity are not gender issues or they're not political issues. Climate change is happening and it's happening in an accelerating rate and it's going to be here whether or not one pretends it's not.
Yeah, but I mean, lots of people in the White House don't agree with that. I mean, that's the point. I mean, they may be wrong, but that's what they think, right?
That's what they think, yes. But a lot of what we're talking about is preventing epidemics, and not just infectious disease epidemics, but obviously, and this is recognized actually by our new leadership in Washington, that Americans are not healthy. And that's true. Our life expectancy has been going down. We are getting fatter. We have a greater prevalence of diabetes. But some of the things that are being said are not scientifically supported. And we really need to have the best science directed to those kinds of conditions.
Are you saying that the changes that have come in since January the 20th go into stopping America's long track record of deep scientific, publicly funded research?
Yes, and that is a terrible loss because we've been able to attract the best minds from around the world to work on challenging problems.
That's the bit that confuses me. I mean, if, you know, America really has benefited from this deep scientific research over the decades, what's your understanding of why that is being cut back?
I wish I knew and could answer that. I think this is self-inflicted damage. It's not going to help. This huge investment that you talk about has been the envy of the world, and we're no longer going to be the place where people go with the best minds, the best scientists go. They're going to go to China. They're going to other places in Europe. And this can be lost very quickly because the kind of damage that's happening can't be rebuilt overnight.
You're making your case very articulately. Do you think more generally there's a problem in American science not communicating as well as other parts of American society?
I think we do quite well communicating amongst ourselves, and now that's being disrupted. I think it's fair to say we haven't communicated as well as we should have with the rest of American society in terms of the results of the science, what is actually good for each person's well-being. That said, there's been a huge effort of disinformation that is very well funded. We don't have funds for communicating where the people behind a lot of disinformation are well funded.
And that was Professor Walter Willett. And now to another Professor Jessica Cantlin, who's at Carnegie Mellon University in Pennsylvania. And she's concerned about the ability of scientists to do just what we're talking about there, communicate, and particularly their cases for funding and their scientific findings and so on. And she told me about the strategies she thinks scientists should be employing to communicate better.
We have just started a project called the Science Homecoming Project, and it's a project where scientists are reconnecting with their hometowns by writing articles in a small town or suburban newspaper. And the goal is to try to bridge the gap between scientists and the public. Over the past few decades, there's been a growing divide between scientists and the public, particularly with people in small towns and suburbs who often don't get to feel like they're in conversation with scientists. And we think that that's part of the problem, in the sense that when you're not in conversation with scientists, that can erode trust in science. And so our approach has been to try to bridge that gap by showing them that science affects every community.
It affects every community, and you can sort of see it all around you. But I see something here saying that you say, write about science in your local newspapers, but don't talk politics. First of all, is that your take on it? Is that what you think is the best way to go about it?
So historically, science has been a bipartisan issue. You know, it's sort of separate from whatever is happening politically. Scientists are looking for facts that are universal truths.
Yeah, but I was just going to push back on that, because, I mean, we're in a different era now, aren't we, where in this post-truth world, you know, universally accepted facts are not universally accepted. And it makes it impossible, I can see, for scientists. But I wonder if you can disaggregate science and politics now.
Yeah, so, you know, the scientific advances that we're talking about are the kinds that save lives, contribute to quality of life, health, economic growth, the kind that advance education, the kinds of advances that have increased life expectancy by 30 years in the past several decades. And those are the kinds of scientific advances that affect everyone, no matter what your politics are.
No, I totally get that. But I mean, there are communities where people are dying of measles because they won't accept the science on the vaccine. And so people are literally dying because of their commitment to false science. So I'm just wondering how you deal with that.
One of the problems in communication is that scientists often have to move to big cities or to college towns for work, but that's not where most scientists are originally from. And so the idea is to try to remind people that the science that you're seeing out in the world originated here. You have some skin in the game. You know somebody from your community. You raise them. They're one of you. You know, a lot of times when people aren't in conversation with scientists, they end up getting their scientific information secondhand. Mm. And that information can come from people with particular interests, maybe in politics or in making money. That can come from misinformation that's spread on our, you know, new forms of communication, like through the internet. And so our idea is that by creating a more direct line between scientists and communities, that people will have better access to the facts and be less likely to become derailed by some of these other forces.
Jessica Cantlon with a communication strategy there, bringing us to an end of this edition of the programme. Thanks for listening. And from Owen Bennett-Jones here in London, goodbye.